Chapter 26. Penn and signed his name to a reprieve, and Angelica ran with it as swift as the wind. Ood better stay, my love, and finish the muffins. There's no use going. Be sure it's too late. Hand me over that raspberry jam, please, said the monarch. Bomb. There goes the half hour. I knew it was. Angelica ran, and ran, and ran, and ran. She ran up 4th Street, and down High Street, and through the marketplace, and down to the left, and over the bridge, and up the blind alley, and back again, and round by the castle, and so along by the haberdashers on the right, opposite the lamp post, and round the square, and she came to the execution place, where she saw Bobo laying his head on the block. The executioner raised his axe, but at that moment the princess came panting up and cried reprieve. Eprov! Screamed the princess. Eprov! Shouted all the people. Up the scaffold stairs she sprang, with the agility of a lighter of lamps, and flinging herself in Bobo's arms, regardless of all ceremony, she cried out, Oh, my prince, my lord, my love, my Bobo! Thine Angelica has been in time, to save thy precious existence, sweet rosebud, to prevent thy being nipped in thy young bloom. Had aught befallen thee, Angelica to have died, and welcome death, that joined her to her Bobo. There's no accounting for tastes, said Bobo, looking so very much puzzled and uncomfortable that the princess, in tones of tenderest strain, asked the cause of his disquiet. I tell you what it is, Angelica, said he, since I came here yesterday, there has been such a row, and disturbance, and quarreling, and fighting, and chopping of heads off, and the deuce to pay, that I am inclined to go back to Crim Tartary. But with me as thy bride, my Bobo, though wherever thou art is Crim Tartary to me, my bold, my beautiful, my Bobo. Well, I suppose we must be married, says Bobo. Octor, you came to read the funeral service, read the marriage service, will you? What must be, must. That will satisfy Angelica, and then, in the name of peace and quietness, do let us go back to breakfast. Bobo had carried a rose in his mouth all the time of the dismal ceremony. It was a fairy rose, and he was told by his mother that he ought never to part with it. So he had kept it between his teeth, even when he laid his poor head upon the block, hoping vaguely that some chance would turn up in his favor. As he began to speak to Angelica, he forgot about the rose, and of course it dropped out of his mouth. The romantic princess instantly stooped and seized it. Sweet rose! She exclaimed, that bloomed upon my Bobo's lip, never will I part from thee. And she placed it in her bosom. And you know Bobo couldn't ask her to give the rose back again. And they went to breakfast. And as they walked, it appeared to Bobo that Angelica became more exquisitely lovely every moment. He was frantic until they were married. And now, strange to say, it was Angelica who didn't care about him. He knelt down, he kissed her hand, he prayed and begged. He cried with admiration. While she for her part said she really thought they might wait, it seemed to her, he was not handsome anymore, no, not at all, quite the reverse, and not clever, no, very stupid, and not well-bred, like Giglio, no, on the contrary, dreadfully vul, what, I cannot say, for King Valoroso roared out, ooh, stuff, in a terrible voice. He will have no more of this shilly-shallying. Call the archbishop, and let the prince and princess be married offhand. So, married they were, and I am sure for my part I trust they will be happy. Zaya! How Betsinda fled, and what became of her? Betsinda wandered on and on, till she passed through the town gates, and so on the great Crim Tartary road, the very way on which Giglio too was going. Thought she, as the diligence passed her, of which the conductor was blowing a delightful tune on his horn, how I should like to be on that coach. But the coach and the jingling horses were very soon gone. She little knew who was in it, though very likely she was thinking of him all the time. Then came an empty cart, returning from market, and the driver being a kind man, and seeing such a very pretty girl trudging along the road with bare feet, most good-naturedly gave her a seat. He said he lived on the confines of the forest, where his old father was a woodman, and, if she liked, he would take her so far on her road. All roads were the same to little Betsinda, so she very thankfully took this one. And the carter put a cloth round her bare feet, and gave her some bread and cold bacon, and was very kind to her. For all that she was very cold and melancholy. When after travelling on, evening came, and all the black pines were bending with snow, and there, at last, was the comfortable light beaming in the woodman's windows, and so they arrived, and went into his cottage. He was an old man, and had a number of children, who were just at supper, with nice hot bread and milk, when their elder brother arrived with the cart. And they jumped and clapped their hands, for they were good children. And he had brought them toys from the town. And when they saw the pretty stranger, they ran to her, and brought her to the fire, and rubbed her poor little feet, and brought her bread and milk. "Look, father," they said to the old woodman, "look at this poor girl, and see what pretty cold feet as he has. They are as white as our milk. And look and see what an odd cloak as he has, just like the bit of velvet that hangs up in our cupboard, and which you found that day the little cubs were killed by King Padella in the forest. And look, why, bless us all, as he has got round her neck just such another little shoe as that you brought home, and have shown us so often a little blue velvet shoe." "What," said the old woodman, "what is all this about a shoe and a cloak?" And Betsinda explained that as he had been left, when quite a little child, at the town with this cloak and this shoe. And the persons who had taken care of her had been angry with her, for no fault, she hoped, of her own. And they had sent her away with her old clothes and here, in fact, she was. She remembered having been in a forest, and perhaps it was a dream it was so very odd and strange having lived in a cave with lions there, and, before that, having lived in a very, very fine house, as fine as the king's, in the town. When the woodman heard this, he was so astonished, it was quite curious, to see how astonished he was. He went to his cupboard, and took out of a stocking a 5-shilling piece of King Cavalfier, and vowed it was exactly like the young woman. And then he produced the shoe, and piece of velvet which he had kept so long, and compared them with the things which Betsinda wore. In Betsinda's little shoe was written, "Hopkins, maker to the royal family," so in the other shoe was written, "Hopkins, maker to the royal family." In the inside of Betsinda's piece of cloak was embroidered, "Prinrosal," in the other piece of cloak was embroidered, "SBA. No. 246. So that when put together you read, "Princess Rosalba. No. 246. On seeing this, the dear old woodman fell down on his knee, saying, "Oh my princess, oh my gracious royal lady, oh my rightful queen of Crim Tartary, I hail thee, I acknowledge thee, I do thee homage." And in token of his fealty, he rubbed his venerable nose 3 times on the ground, and put the princess's foot on his head. "Why," said she, "my good woodman, you must be a nobleman of my royal father's court. For in her lowly retreat, and under the name of Betsinda, her majesty, Rosalba, queen of Crim Tartary, had read of the customs of all foreign courts and nations. Mary, indeed, am I, my gracious liege the poor Lord Spinacci once the humble woodman these 15 years sin ever since the tyrant Padella may ruin overtake the treacherous knave. Dismiss me from my post of first lord of the toothpick and joint keeper of the snuff box. I mind me, thou heldest these posts under our royal sire. They are restored to thee, Lord Spinacci. I make thee knight of the second class of our order of the pumpkin, the first class being reserved for crowned heads alone. Rise, Marquis of Spinacci." And with indescribable majesty, the queen, who had no sword handy, waved the pewter spoon with which as he had been taking her bread and milk, over the bald head of the old nobleman, whose tears absolutely made a puddle on the ground, and whose dear children went to bed that night, lords and ladies Bartolomeo, Ibaldo, Caterina, and Ottavia degli Spinacci. The acquaintance Her Majesty showed with the history and noble families of her empire was wonderful. The House of Broccoli should remain faithful to us, she said. They were ever welcome at our court. Have the Artisiaki, as was their wont, turned to the rising sun? The family of sauerkraut must sure be with us, they were ever welcome in the halls of King Cavalfier. And so she went on enumerating quite a list of the nobility and gentry of Crim Tartary, so admirably had Her Majesty profited by her studies while in exile. The old Marquis of Spinachi said he could answer for them all, that the whole country groaned under Padella's tyranny, and longed to return to its rightful sovereign. And late as it was, he sent his children, who knew the forest well, to summon this nobleman and that. And when his eldest son, who had been rubbing the horse down and giving him his supper, came into the house for his own, the Marquis told him to put his boots on, and a saddle on the mare, and ride hither and thither to such and such people. When the young man heard who his companion in the cart had been, he too knelt down, and put a royal foot on his head. He too bedewed the ground with his tears. He was frantically in love with her, as everybody now was who saw her. So were the young lords Bartolomeo and Ibaldo, who punched each other's little heads out of jealousy. And so, when they came from east and west at the summons of the Marquis degli Spinacci, were the Crim Tartar lords who still remained faithful to the House of Cavalfier. They were such very old gentlemen for the most part, that Her Majesty never suspected their absurd passion, and went among them quite unaware of the havoc her beauty was causing, until an old blind lord who had joined her party told her what the truth was. After which, for fear of making the people too much in love with her, she always wore a veil. She went about privately, from one nobleman's castle to another, and they visited among themselves again, and had meetings, and composed proclamations and counter-proclamations, and distributed all the best places of the kingdom amongst one another, and selected who of the opposition party should be executed, when the queen came to her own. And so in about a year they were ready to move. The party of fidelity was in truth composed of very feeble old fogies for the most part. They went about the country waving their old swords and flags, and calling God save the Queen. And King Padella happening to be absent upon an invasion, they had their own way for a little, and to be sure the people were very enthusiastic whenever they saw the Queen. Otherwise the vulgar took matters very quietly, for they said, as far as they could recollect, they were pretty well as much taxed in Cavalfier's time, as now in Padella's. Z. How Queen Rosalba came to the castle of the bold Count Aganarmo. Her Majesty, having indeed nothing else to give, made all her followers knights of the pumpkin, and marquises, earls, and baronets. And they had a little court for her, and made her a little crown of gilt paper, and a robe of cotton velvet, and they quarreled about the places to be given away in her court, and about rank and precedence and dignities. You can't think how they quarreled. The poor queen was very tired of her honors, before she had had them a month, and I dare say sighed sometimes, even to be a lady's maid again. But we must all do our duty in our respective stations, so the queen resigned herself to perform hers. We have said how it happened that none of the usurper's troops came out to oppose this army of fidelity. It pottered along as nimbly as the gout of the principal commanders allowed. It consisted of twice as many officers as soldiers. And at length passed near the estates of one of the most powerful noblemen of the country, who had not declared for the queen, but of whom her party had hopes, as he was always quarreling with King Padella. When they came close to his park gates, this nobleman sent to say he would wait upon Her Majesty. He was a most powerful warrior, and his name was Count Aganarmo, whose helmet it took two strong negroes to carry. He knelt down before her and said, Madam and liege lady, it becomes the great nobles of the Crimean realm to show every outward sign of respect to the wearer of the crown, whoever that may be. We testify to our own nobility in acknowledging yours. The bold Hagenarmo bends the knee to the first of the aristocracy of his country. Rosalba said the bold Count of Hagenarmo was uncommonly kind, but she felt afraid of him, even while he was kneeling, and his eyes scowled at her from between his whiskers, which grew up to them. The first Count of the Empire, Madam, he went on, salutes the sovereign. The prince addresses himself to the not more noble lady. Madam, my hand is free, and I offer it, and my heart and my sword to your service. My three wives lie buried in my ancestral vaults. The third perished, but a year since, and this heart pines for a consort. Deign to be mine, and I swear to bring to your bridal table the head of King Padella, the eyes and nose of his son Prince Bulbo, the right hand and ears of the usurping sovereign of Paphlagonia, which country shall thenceforth be an appanage to ear to our crown. Say yes, Hagenarmo is not accustomed to be denied. Indeed I cannot contemplate the possibility of a refusal, for frightful will be the result, dreadful the murders, furious the devastations, horrible the tyranny, tremendous the tortures, misery, taxation, which the people of this realm will endure, if Hagenarmo's wrath be aroused. I see consent in your majesty's lovely eyes, their glances fill my soul with rapture. Oh, sir, Rosalba said, withdrawing her hand in great fright, your lordship is exceedingly kind. But I am sorry to tell you that I have a prior attachment to a young gentleman by the name of Prince Giglio, and never can marry anyone but him. Who can describe Hagenarmo's wrath at this remark? Rising up from the ground, he ground his teeth, so that fire flashed out of his mouth, from which at the same time issued remarks and language, so loud, violent, and improper, that this pen shall never repeat them. Rejected. Fiends and perdition. The bold Hagenarmo rejected. All the world shall hear of my rage, and you, madam, you above all shall rue it. And kicking the two negroes before him, he rushed away, his whiskers streaming in the wind. Her Majesty's Privy Council was in a dreadful panic when they saw Hagenarmo issue from the royal presence in such a towering rage, making footballs of the poor negroes, a panic which the events justified. They marched off from Hagenarmo's park very crestfallen, and in another half hour they were met by that rapacious chieftain with a few of his followers, who cut, slashed, charged, whacked, banged, and pommeled amongst them, took the queen prisoner, and drove the army of fidelity to I don't know where. Poor queen! Hagenarmo, her conqueror, would not condescend to see her. At a horse van, he said to his grooms, clap the hussy into it, and send her, with my compliments, to his majesty King Padella. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.